morning, everybody. Welcome to our latest podcast where we're going to be discussing all things Q4 participation, prep, engagement, all to do with Amazon. We've got some fantastic guests again from brand in-house agency. So hopefully we'll give you a full 360 view of the Q4 period and what we've seen historically and top trends that we're expecting to see for this season as well. If we can just kick off with a couple of very, very quick intros. Trav, let's go first.
Hey, everyone. Trav, head of vendor services. I don't always wear this turkey hat, but obviously, since it is the season, I thought I might as well go all in. I head up the vendor services division, got about 6-7 years of Amazon experience, been in the Amazon game, starting at Amazon, gone to pharmaceuticals, and now I head up the vendor services side of things at Venture Forge. Looking forward to today.
Fantastic. Thanks, Trav. I should have made a bit of a disclaimer around the Christmas attire as well, shouldn't I?
It's very Christmas heavy, this side of the room.
Emma, would you like to go next?
Hi, I'm Emma. I'm head of seller at Venture Forge. I've got about 10 plus years of experience working in e-commerce, whether it's agency side or working in-house. And yeah, really excited for today.
Fantastic. Thanks, Emma. And then Tom?
Yeah, hi, guys. So I'm Tom from Tetrasil. We are the biggest car care manufacturer in Europe. We have quite a big in-house Amazon team, which I head up. I previously worked at an agency, so I've got a bit of in-house and agency experience of about 5 or 6 years.
Fantastic. Some of the coolest offices we've ever seen.
Yes, yeah, it's pretty cool offices. Yeah.
I was just waiting to drop that bit in there. Fantastic, thank you very much, guys. Well, look, I guess we'll kick off kind of right at the top then. Obviously, we said we're going to talk about Q4, what it means to retail, what it means to Amazon, and how we kind of get ready for Q4. If we can start right at the top then. So whenever we talk about Q4, you picture 3 months, October, November, December. But in reality, what does that actually mean, Emma?
So it is known as the golden quarter. It is where most people, well, most businesses make the majority of their cash is in that golden quarter. Starting in October, you're looking at Amazon's Prime Day, which you don't get the dates until they fancy dropping those. Then you're leading into what is now known as the Cyber Five, which is Cyber Monday, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and however many weeks they feel like marketing that, because it's just growing month and week. Yes. It's just never ending. And then we go into the Christmas period, which is panic buyers and people looking for those very quick, very easily purchased Christmas gifts. And you do find that people are shopping up until the very, very last minute, which is where we can cash in more.
Yeah, I always remember speaking to clients right on that cut-off date of how long can you fulfill Prime. Yeah. Prime very quickly goes from 24 hours to 48 and then starts to slip, doesn't it? So you can definitely see those trends starting to fade a little bit. Yep. Is there anything else you guys see from a brand perspective?
Just what you mentioned there on the how long do Amazon actually keep Prime available for. Obviously on the vendor side, we really struggled last year to actually get stock in. So I'm sure we'll go on to it a little bit more later, but that was our biggest issue. I mean, we're probably sort of 25% of the PO value last sort of November compared to what we were previously. Wow. So I'm sure there's loads of people that experience this, but the FCs get so full so quickly. Yeah. That was probably our biggest sort of takeaway from last year. Yeah.
Do you think that'll get worse this year? Because there's a lot of talk in the industry about warehousing starting to decrease already.
I constantly think it's going to be getting worse year over year. As many sort of warehouses they keep building, that's as many sellers keep onboarding onto Amazon. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as your operations grow, your logistics need to grow, your warehouse space needs to grow, you get new NPD. It's just a self-fulfilling prophecy, essentially. So worse year over year, essentially. So as soon as you get those POs, confirm them, pick them, pack them, send them, get it sorted. If Amazon turns your way, reschedule it, get it done. I think it's just going to get worse year over year, in all honesty.
Completely agree, And we're seeing it now, as you rightly say. We're really not even into Prime Day, common periods, are we?
Yeah, that's exactly what we've seen with Prime Day at the moment. So,
And that's going to have a knock-on effect. So July's Prime 4 days is what we're hearing. That's having a large knock-on effect on people prepping for Q4.
Yeah.
Because people do start dropping stuff in sooner rather than later because they do face that there's no room in the inn.
Yeah. So what do you guys recommend is the best way to do it? Is it forward orders? We've even gone down the bulk buy route because we, on some lines where there's a little bit more margin, we can accept like a 5% discount.
Yeah.
Obviously not available for all lines because some of them are really low margin. Obviously we're a little bit different in Q4 to most sort of other vendors, if you like, because we sell commodity type products, so we sell a lot of de-ice, so it's very sort of weather dependent. And the feedback we get is always from Amazon is the FCs, we don't want de-icer, we want toys and gifts, but they still have to sell de-icers, so it's still, the demand's still there, they still have to stock it, so it's a little bit different for us compared to what a normal Q4 is, but it's the same, the sales spike because the demand is there.
I think that's also, if you can, to be honest, vendor flex nodes come in quite handy throughout that time, even if you don't use it throughout the entire year. Set up a vendor flex node just so they can easily sort of distribute the stock as and when needed, essentially, or drastic times go hybrid model and sort of preload as much stock as you can a few months ahead of the time. Rather be overstocked ahead of sort of peak period, run per promos to run down that age stock, than be sitting there scratching your heads, guys, we can't get enough stock in. So if you do have a hybrid model, use that seller option months ahead of sort of peak period, sell it through, and then slowly just keep feeding the algorithm and the seller rate, essentially.
Cool. So I think if we go right back to the kind of that, the top of it, and the first question was, there's probably three really significant parts in that Q4 then. So Prime Day, which seems to really kick off that retail calendar. Then moving into Black Friday, Cyber Weekend, as you say, seems to have a knock-on
Cyber
effect.
Cyber 5,
Cyber 10 by the end of the month.
Yeah.
And then that real true sort of gifting right up until the last minute and kind of those fulfillment windows. I think what's really interesting though, and I was looking at some data from this the other day, if you look at how Prime Day's grown year on year, previous years have been sort of 10% year on year growth, but then we're talking billions of pounds from a retail perspective. It's so, so big. I mean, the slow is starting to kick in. So you're talking 8% last year versus prior year. So it's slowing, but it's still significant. But I think what's really interesting is if you look at the retail impact that's happening now. So obviously I know you operate across multi-markets as well, multi-marketplace, should I say. Onbuy, Argos, Tesco's are all starting to do different events themselves.
They all just wait for it. As soon as those Prime Days are announced, that's like, red lights are flashing within John Lewis, Argos, all the competitors, and they're like, cool, well, we know those dates over that time period. We need to be running as strategic deals, as deep deals, because they're also not dumb. They know Amazon price matches. So if they can sort of price match the price and the customer can get similar product, or if there's an out of stock at Amazon, they can go to Argos, John Lewis and get it. You've won that sale essentially from Amazon. So to be brutally honest, I would probably do the same if I was in their sort of position. I mean, if not, why not? People's already got a buying sort of appetite, so ride the wave as long as you can.
Yeah. Do you think it's a change in consumer behavior that's driven that from retailers then?
100%.
Yeah.
People almost expect discounts now, as weird as it is. I mean, Amazon, people go there for a good deal. Let's just be real. We can all admit it. If you go there and you see a product on sale, you go and you check the historical price and you're like, ooh, I might just wait a few weeks and then get it on deal during Prime Day, Black Friday, Christmas. If it's not something that you need immediately, you'd rather wait a little bit for that TV, that PlayStation, that Xbox, whatever it is. And if you can save 20% on it, why not?
Yeah,
100%. And is that the same across wider retail as well then, do you think? Or is that just an Amazon mindset?
No, I think wider retail, because it's either you fit in or you get forgotten, essentially, like that. So if they're not adopting the same principles that Amazon is, why would a customer want to go shop by them? They just giving all the sales to Amazon, essentially. So I think most retailers are starting to play the game, essentially.
Yeah. We get retailers come to us and ask for, like, so they can match the same RRP. I mean, they can't really talk about pricing, but that's sort of what they're suggested is during that period, if you're doing something on Amazon, what can we do in John Lewis or whatever?
Okay. Do you see that the other way?
We absolutely see it the other way. Amazon will always come to us and say, if we're on a promo somewhere else, can we have a promo on Amazon during that same period? They want to match. Yeah. They want to do their own deals and then match the entire, like, business-wide deals as well.
Yeah, I feel like I might touch the nerve then.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a safe space. Yeah.
But we see, I mean, when we're talking to some of our really big clients or similar to yourselves, the conversations you have to have around SOAs, contributions, it's a 6-8 week conversation sometimes. Mm-hmm. And the depth and complexity of what's been asked sometimes is that significant that it does take that long to work through.
What do you generally see when you're speaking to clients on the promotions? Do you generally see people do the promotions based on, like, the profitability, that line level? Or do you see people just go really big to try and push a new line?
It's really different.
Yeah, I think it really depends on what industry they're in, but also are they going to have a loss leader? So, for example, are you going to... Let's take Oral-B, for example. They'll probably sell their toothbrushes at, like, flat margin, maybe a bit of a loss. But the accessories, the bolt-ons, like the replacement heads, that's where the customers keep coming back and buying it. So if you want to have a loss leader to make an entry into the market, but you know, customers essentially later on down the line are going to keep buying more, or run a PlayStation at a discount and then they know they're going to continue to buy the games for it. It really depends on your strategy. So it's a line level profitability thing. If they can afford to give it away to get the customer in the door and win the sale, ultimately I think they do it if their margin allows.
More and more it is becoming line by line, noting the profitability and then promoting according to that. It's less, let's just do 20% off.
Yeah. I think the other thing that's quite interesting, the more clients talk, is obviously stock holding. Do you have the stock position and you want to only move that stock quite quickly? And then again, Emma, you started to talk about kind of that lag or hangover effect, if you like, is if you discount in peak or for that trade period, should we say, what's the impact going to be on the wider business for the following 5, 10, 15 days? Mm-hmm. So actually, do you just deplete margin for no reason? Because then you've got no hangover sales to then incorporate on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think from us, we would do it at a line level.
Yeah.
But unless we really want to go aggressive and we're trying to launch a new line or push a new line, then we'd go incredibly aggressive on the promotion, because as you'll have seen, the long lasting effect of if you get it right, so promotion, advertising, get the listing perfect, it's way more than what the promotion will actually cost you. But you've got to get it right, and it doesn't work every single time. So
100%, yeah. And I think that's a lot of the things, and we'll come on to try to talk about the data. Excuse me, data's got to do the talking. You know, is there actually value in discounting, or Amazon's just asking for contribution for the sake of asking for contributions?
Yeah.
And you think about the long-term view again, because on Prime Day, for example, if you discount at 30%, if you do it on Black Friday, it needs to match that or go deeper. So if you go too deep too early on, you need to comp that end of the year. So if you deplete all your margin, you're missing out on Black Friday, you're missing out on Christmas, you're missing out on a whole lot of other sales because of Amazon's deal tenants. Needs to be the lowest price year to date or X percentage off trailing 30 days. So you need to be quite strategic with it. You can't just throw everything and hope it sticks. You need to be quite surgical, if I can say it like that.
We've kind of started talking about how we do it and what we do. Excuse me. Just going back to kind of that top level, and probably sticking this side of the room if we can for now. Are there any categories you see that do better than other categories in that Q4 period?
Toys.
Toys.
I mean, I was about to say, I think that's a really low-hanging fruit. Like, I mean, toys. Every kid wants to wake up on Christmas Day with a cool Lego set, cool PlayStation. Thanks, Mom and Dad. Beauty does exceptionally well as well. My previous experience was beauty. Everyone's mum, nan, sister loves waking up to a gift set on it. And also, it's easy for us doing the shopping. So beauty, obviously electrical, people go get their Christmas bonuses, they get their sort of salaries earlier, they want a bigger TV, they want the new sexy sounds sort of bar, whatever it is. So it's electronics, toys and beauty do exceptionally well during end of year.
Post Christmas, it's books. People, I think did we see it last year where the most popular day on for shopping on Amazon was Christmas Day and Boxing Day?
So surprising.
So it was people sat on Christmas Day with their gift vouchers or money, and they were just spending because there's nothing else to do in between eating and opening presents. So it was one of like the most popular shopping days was actually Christmas Day.
That's really interesting.
So books, audio books.
Yeah, everyone's starting those New Year's resolutions as well.
Yeah, I'm going to read a book. Yeah.
And do you think, Trav, just going back to the point around kind of some of the categories you mentioned there, specifically kind of the health and beauty and the toys and games, do you think that's a price point factor?
Oh, yeah.
I think it is a price point factor just purely because of the competition in the market. In all honesty, there's new entrants every single month, almost every single day, I'm sure, within the beauty category. If you can get something sourced from the Far East and it hits all health and safety regulations, you can package it up nicely and give a price point, people are going to buy it. Same as toys. If you can get a good manufacturer to manufacture something that's on trend, or if you can license a brand that's going to sell itself, for example, it really is. So price point is a big factor, but I think also name brand things. So for example, Lego, everyone has played with Lego at some point in their life, and you know it's going to sell itself. Same as sort of gift sets. You want to give your mom a gift set, you want to give your nan a gift set. So there's just certain bits and pieces where I think brands are able to go that deep because they know it's going to sell itself. They're not going to be sitting with excess stock. They're not going to be sitting out with Amazon coming knocking on the door and saying, hey, look, we're overstocked end of the year, we need to do returns, we need to do deep discounts, we need to get rid of the stock. So yeah, I'd say price point is a big factor on it.
But also purchasing behavior. So how people are purchasing through Prime Day or like the Cyber Five, they are very price conscious. But when you get up to that week leading up to Christmas, it's panic purchasing. So they're less price conscious because they just need to get it bought. It needs to arrive and they need to wrap it in time for Christmas. So it's taking into consideration how the consumer is actually placing those orders throughout those weeks, months.
Obviously, within the Q4 period, we've kind of started to talk about price point, different consumers, different behaviours. Would you use each of those three periods, so the Prime, Cyber Weekend, and obviously that Q4 spike kind of right up to Christmas Day, for different strategies, different products, different approaches?
Definitely, where you have the potential for a price decrease and promotions, you would use those specific products where you've got the margin, you can afford to drop that price for the first two, so the Cyber Week and Prime Day. And then when you're looking towards going closer to Christmas, you can utilize more of the design elements of your Amazon storefront, your A+ content, and you can really push towards the, you're really panicking buying now for your Christmas presents. And yeah, you can, from organically, you can make changes, but then also the strategy for the discounted days.
Yeah.
You would create their own strategy for those.
Do you know what? Let's come back to that, because I think that's, content is a real part that's overlooked. 100%. Quite significantly. I think whenever we talk about strategies on Amazon, you're talking about discounting, SOAs, stock, that content is a real, real key factor. Mm-hmm. And again, how consumers are searching. So that shift from a gift for Father's Day to a gift for Dad for Christmas. We haven't mentioned automotive. Do you see a Q4 spike?
We do see a Q4 spike. We do have particular gifting products. So we have gift packs for Car Gods, which is our premium brand, and then Car Plan Demon, which is sort of our retail brand. We see a massive increase on our premium brand generally in Q4 because I think when it's on Prime, people think, oh, we're going to treat ourselves to a little bit more luxury rather than like the retail type brand. So we do see a big increase there.
Yeah.
For more of our established brands, we don't necessarily, but we do, for like, we have a screen wash which goes down to minus 15 degrees. So that does really well. We've got de-icer, we've got five or six different de-icers, we've got scrapers. We see massive spikes on those.
That's interesting. And do you see a difference across those three periods, or is it very consistent?
We definitely see a spike for the luxury items earlier on because, as you said, people, they're the price conscious ones. They want to get a deal. They want to get a luxury product, a premium detailing brand for cheaper than they would normally pay. We do see an increase in the gifting. So we have the gift packs as we get closer to Christmas.
Yeah.
Generally, it's very weather dependent for the rest of it, but it aligns with Q4. So it's, we're trying to sell weather dependent products when the FCs are full.
Yeah.
And when there's all these issues that everybody else has, we're trying to do it at the same time as not necessarily selling the Q4 appropriate product.
Yeah, definitely. And I think we'll come back to the FC bit in a bit more detail, because I think that's going to be a huge hot topic of conversation. Yeah. Fulfillment methods, backing up, making sure you've got enough stock availability. And then the hangover effect. So we've kind of started to touch on this. We see it in all clients, I think, pretty much, and it's such a big conversation we have, and it's not even a Q4 thing, it's just a discounting thing. You know, we spoke about kind of what is a peak period. A peak period isn't just big retail calendar events, it's a hot sunny day. You know, I'm out cleaning my car last weekend, I want that complete pickup purchase, I need some shampoo for my car, etc., I'll do it. How do you manage that hangover effect, or how do you mitigate the impact of it? Because it's going to happen.
Yeah. So I'd say you got to ride the wave of it. Like hangover effect, halo effect, whatever label you want to put onto it, especially during those types of periods, is of a seasonality, like you mentioned, comes into play. But around key deal events, do lead up to the deal events, the actual deal events, and then do a lead out for it. So have like specific products for specific times during that entire period. So maybe some easy vouchers leading up to it, some really deep discounts, top deals, where you get the nice deal badge, you get the nice strike through rate, which really obviously incentivizes the customer. And then afterwards do lead out deals also. So it really depends on your overall strategy, what margin you want to do. But I'd say do a full 360 view. Don't just have like Prime Day deals for two or four days this year and that's that. Do a lead up to Prime Day, Prime Day, and a lead out to Prime Day, because people are still buying it. They still have buying behavior. They still have appetite for it. And I mean, if you're not going to be doing it, your competitors are going to be doing it. So rather have it and not need it than need it and not have it type thing. So I always see it.
And would you see a difference in, sorry, Emma, I'm going to put you on the spot now here. Do you see a difference in seller and vendor? Are there different ways different platforms can be used?
Seller, definitely, from a fulfillment side of things, and purchasing behavior as well is completely different.
I think also one thing, and it breaks my soul to say it, one thing that Seller does really well is brand-tailored promotions.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'll let Emma speak about that. Obviously, vendor, you got your VM coming and being like, hey, give me 30% off. And you're like, where have you pulled that number from, mate? Mm-hmm. It makes no sense. Yeah. Whereas brand-tailored promotions, I don't want to steal your thunder, so I'm not going to. You can obviously market to customers that follow your brand store, or they follow your brand, or they've put your product in a basket but not checked out. And obviously, you can also retarget with advertising sort of bits and pieces through that. So there are different ways and means. On the interface, customers won't really notice it. Obviously, FBA is still going to be next day service. Same with vendor, going to be next day service. FBM, there might be a little bit of lag or all those good things. But especially on promotions, brand-tailored promotions, I absolutely love them. Even
Seller
though
just has more control.
Yeah.
We have control over everything compared to vendor. So like you said, the brand tailored promotions, you can toggle between your FBM and FBA listings. So you can look at the margin for either of those and really strategize according to how you're actually shipping that product out.
Yeah.
There's so much more that we can control within the seller space.
100%. You're a hybrid as well, aren't you?
Yeah, so we're hybrid in the UK and then pretty much vendor everywhere else, mm-hmm. apart from Japan, where we have a seller account there.
Yeah.
But going back to what Trav was saying, we've started to change from just going for the big deal events, because what we've seen is everybody's on deal then. Mm-hmm. And unless you're the biggest deal, it just doesn't work for us. Yeah. So we tend to do it before. We're trialing it this year has been sort of our first year doing it. So we're trialing it outside of all of these promos. The vendor manager doesn't actually like it as much, because I don't know whether they're sort of targeted on getting these big discounts on the big deal events, but they prefer it when we do it during like Prime Day and Cyber Monday things. But yeah, we've seen great success actually from doing it outside of it, because when you're trying to steal a customer from a competitor, it's really hard to do it when everybody's at 25% discount.
It's the whole reason why Cyber Black Friday have expanded the way that they have, is because businesses were promoting outside of that Black Friday, last shopping Friday of the month in November. And it's the whole reason why now it's 2 weeks and it's expanding to 3 weeks and like pre-Black Friday sales. Yeah. So Prime Day is going in that way, where businesses are seeing the opportunity to promote outside of those set days. You'll see so many more customers shopping the day after Prime Day ends, because there's still those promotions running and people are still riding that wave.
Yeah.
It's just the natural behavior now.
Do you know what? I thought this conversation was going to go this way. You start off with Q4 and then you very quickly expand to hangover planning. What's prior to planning?
It's just a constant thing, though. That's it. You need to have not an always on strategy, but you need to be consciously always ready to move. If your competitors do, it's like, hey, let's put in a deal to counteract that. You may not be able to block them completely, but if you can stop some of their sales, isn't that kind of one of the goals as well? Obviously, growth is one thing, but if you can erode their market share, or you can sort of capture some of their customers, and you know, later on down the line, they're like, hey, you know, these products I got from Tetrasol, they're awesome stuff. Let's go rebuy it, like, instead of going to one of your competitors and redoing it. So yeah, I think it needs to be an always on mindset, but not always on promotions, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think we see it best in effect on the commodity lines. So screen washers, we actually have the best selling fire extinguisher on Amazon, which you wouldn't know because we do automotive, but that product,
everyone's cooking that turkey and they're burning the house down,
and that product is, when it's on promotion, just absolutely flies, because ultimately no one really cares what fire extinguisher it is. They just want the cheapest one that's going to do the job. So it's stuff like that where it's really price sensitive.
Do you know what, you said something interesting then, Trav, the always on effect. Something we talk to clients about quite a lot is off-season strategies. And again, you were kind of saying this about what your deal events and when you discount, when you don't discount. I think it's something that's massively overlooked, is because everyone's in discount. Yes, there's latent demand, but you're right, it's more competitive. Cost per clicks are higher. Chance of conversion is lower, because there's so many more different people doing different things. If you can actually look at that off-season strategy, the chance of organic ranking or organic climbing, however you want to word it, is actually significantly cheaper.
Yeah.
So you can get so much gain. Of course, velocity is a lot slower because sell-through is going to be a lot slower. But if you can rank higher, you're naturally going to convert stronger, which means you're naturally going to sell more products. So again, there's a lot of merit in starting to look at what your all year round calendar looks like.
Mm-hmm. That's it. Yeah, get the reviews and ratings. Your brand sort of velocity and sales velocity might not be there, but you're still getting the reviews, still getting the recognition. You're still getting on the buyers if it's a repeat purchase, like a FMCG product. I mean, selling a TV, for example, once you've got a TV, you probably have a TV. You're not going to go buy one every other month, but that's where FMCG comes. And if you've got skincare products, you know, every single month you're going to need a new skincare cream, or you're going to put it on subscribe and save. You know what I mean? It's going to be continuous purchases outside of deal events. So, you know, you've got a constant consumer base more than anything.
Definitely.
100%. Perfect. So I guess one of the points we haven't spoken about, or we've kind of started to talk about, is inventory and fulfillment, which is obviously a massive, massive one, not just at peak periods or trading periods, but kind of all year round. Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the biggest things that we, or I feel a lot of people talk about, is stock forecasting. How do you accurately forecast stock for Amazon?
Nice. So I think accurately is the golden word there. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can fully always accurately do it, because it also depends on customer demand, what price points you're going to go in, historical sales. But I think first and foremost is look at your historical data. What did you do last deal period? What have you done in the months preceding, sort of leading up to the actual deal event, and sort of look there and then apply probably to a 20-30% increase on that stock. So Amazon generally says during their deal periods, they see a 20-30% increase in sales. Whether that's true or not, let's just trust in Amazon and say it is. But look at your historical data, look at your historical run rates. Also, if you've ran a similar price promotion on a similar price product, use that data and factor that into your forecasting. Essentially, it's not an exact science. I don't ever really trust Amazon's forecasting metrics. Very rarely do you actually get access to an in-stock manager. I'm not saying it's impossible, but some brands can negotiate that as part of AVN terms, which really does help and gives you a bit more of an accurate picture. But I'd say first and foremost, look at your historical sales and look at your historical data and then build it from there.
Yeah. How do you manage that with a VM or an AVS? Because of course they're going to push you on PO acceptance rates. You're going to have force born to runs. If it's not enough, it very much feels like it's an automated approach.
We have a few different ways of doing it. I mean, it's so difficult to trust the P90 forecast or any of their forecasting tools. We literally last week had a product that Amazon have 2 years stock cover for. So they already have that, and then ordered another 2,000 units. Which just makes no sense to us. Like, it wasn't in the forecast, because why would they do that?
Yeah.
So it is just really difficult to forecast it. We do a few probably quirky things. We'll ask for manual buys or bulk buys.
Yep.
So we'll get the bulk buys in for like 2 months down the line. We will then bring the window forward. Then we can ship it in whenever within that period. We constantly extend shipping windows, because we can manufacture, probably takes us about a week to manufacture, depending on the amount of units, but 2,000 units of anything we've got. So we can extend the window and deliver it in that. And then a ship window override, we've got 14 days at the moment, which I believe is pretty much the maximum you can get.
Yeah.
So that's the other thing that we do.
Okay. Yeah. It's a few different ways that you can manage it. How about seller? Because you have a little bit more leniency, but obviously not. You've still got a space that you can fill.
Yeah, with seller, again, it's that line-by-line strategy with regards to stock management. Again, historical data is key. You need to look at what you were doing before. You can't just finger in the air, guess what to send in, because you're paying for that to sit there. But obviously, you do not want to get in the position when you're in a stock out, because replenishing that stock is impossible when you get into peak season. You do have to do a lot of fore planning with regards to actually your shipment plans and getting everything into the fulfillment centers in time.
Yeah.
What would normally be a week to 2 weeks of shipping it in and it being on the shelf, double, triple that time frame. You have to be fully prepared. Yeah. And I think we touched on it before, our clients have to be prepared to pay for those storage costs, because you would rather be a little bit more stock heavy than too little stock.
Yeah, you can always run promotions and delete the stock.
Look into the bundling if you're really struggling with that storage cost.
Yeah.
But I would always prefer to be in a position of, I've got a little too much.
Yeah, and you sort of touched on it earlier, born to run. We've been seeing it time and time again where clients are like, Trav, we can't get stock in. our Born to Run's not working. And the first question I always ask is this a new product or has it already got historical sales? And they're like, oh no, it's a bestseller. It's been selling for years. I'm like, that's the biggest problem. Born to Run's a launch buy program. It's for new products that don't have much sales history or none at all, actually. Yeah. And it's for you to get that stock in to initially start generating POs. So back to your point also, if you do want to get stock in on Born to Run and it's a new product, rather put in more than less, essentially, like that, especially if you're going into peak period, because if there's any stock left over, either Amazon's going to take it at a discount and you're still already going to lose margin, but you'd rather have more there than less to sort of satisfy the customer essentially and not have stock outs. 100%. So this is for like all listeners, make sure you only use Born to Run for new products.
Yeah, it's the same when you kind of spoke tongue in cheek about bulk buys. You're like, we do it, we don't really want to do it, but we have to do it sometimes.
Yeah, we'd rather do it than not have the sale is what we look at it as. I mean, we actually do use Born to Run for stuff if we need to get stock in pretty much all regions, if we really need to get the stock into, because Amazon would just, their algorithm is not as good as they think either. Yeah. So they just won't order, even if they're selling loads of it.
Yeah, 100%. And I guess you kind of start to talk about different markets and regions, things. And I guess when you're going talking about lead times as well, in those markets where you have got a longer lead time for DE, France, whatever it might be, having that excess stock and potentially using a 3PL as an option is a good option as well.
Yep.
What about 3PLs? Anybody got any thoughts on how you could use those guys for the trading periods?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on your business model as well, because if you keep stock in local regions within your own warehouse, you need to be able to pay tax in that region. So you need to have tax for Germany and like Spain and all that. And a lot of customers don't get that. They don't understand that. If Amazon takes it and transitions it, or you ship from mainland UK to EU, you don't need it. But as soon as it lands in a warehouse and touches that soil, you need sort of tax status essentially within. You need that paperwork done. So if you can get a 3PL, sell it on consignment, they can sell it on, that's your business. Go for it. It's great. As long as they have all the paperwork and it works out for you, then, I mean, as long as everyone's happy end of the day, then win-win.
Yeah.
So I've got good views on it, but 3PL is obviously the more FBA side of things. But if you're with Amazon and you do cross-border selling or cross-border fulfillment, Amazon generally handles most of that as part of the negotiation terms, or if you do super picks or anything like that in the EU.
And it's logistically how that works for you, because involving a 3PL completely changes the setup and how operationally that works for you as a business. So it has to be a business by business case.
Yeah, 100%. And definitely you've got options like Pan-EU as well. Mm-hmm. Am I right in saying vendor, they now buy in Poland and then distribute across the EU? Is that right?
I think that's like for if they go into Germany and France and sort of close hubs within Poland. But I mean, it also really depends on how big your network is.
Yeah.
Since we left the EFN, the UK, it used to be called the European Fulfillment Network. Yes. You could just transship stuff overnight, which is excellent. Whereas now you kind of hamstrung a little bit and you just can't. So yeah, Poland is the main hub, but I think it really depends how big your operations are and where they need stock essentially.
Yeah. No, that makes complete sense. And then when we talk about fulfillment methods, obviously there's quite a lot of different fulfillment methods are available now, even on vendor models. It used to be very traditional, buy the stock, they'd fulfill, that was kind of it. We spoke about DI, kind of vendor flex, there's so many different options. How do you plan, prioritize? How should you choose? What shouldn't you choose? I've got a feeling this is going to open a bit of a can of worms.
I think it really depends on your own businesses. Sort of position, essentially, how much help do you need? How good are your current relationships with your current logistical providers? Do you ship with DHL, for example, that has a global presence and can ship rest in the EU? Or I'm not 100% sure on every status, but if that's just a local UK entity, they can't ship EU, that type of thing. So what kind of relationships do you currently have? How can you leverage those relationships to sort of expand it into the EU? But then on the flip side, if you don't have those relationships, what type of terms are you getting from Amazon? Are they asking for 8%? No, you're not going to pay that. Can you negotiate it down? No, you can't negotiate it down. Okay, I need to look for a logistical provider. So I think it really depends on the business's use case. Also the type of product you're selling. If you're selling big, bulky products, it's going to be more expensive to sell into different regions. If there's region constrictions, so if there's certain ingredients that's banned in certain countries, you can't sell in those countries, so you can't ship via those countries. There's a lot of small bits and pieces to fit into the overall puzzle. It's not just pack it on a truck or a ship and send it. It's also local laws, local regulations.
I bet you'll fall foul of a lot of those kind of things, won't you, with the variation in products?
We do. I mean, we generally have a lot of, well, we can generally sell most of the products across Europe. Okay. We have a lot of the languages on it, which is the biggest thing for us. We have all the safety data sheets and everything, but the languages on the actual product is the biggest thing for us. What we see in Germany is that it can't be a secondary language. Okay. It needs to be the main language on the actual bottle of things, whereas everywhere else is generally happy just to accept that it's one of the languages on the packaging. But in terms of fulfillment, we will try and do generally what we do throughout the year, which is just Amazon buy it, we ship it to the FC, and that's all fine. As a backup method, we then have a seller account, so a hybrid model, but pretty much anything below about £12 as an RRP just does not work for us.
Okay.
So, and I said the ISP is £7.54, so quite a lot of the catalogue doesn't work. And then as a backup, we have direct fulfillment. So we just, the main thing for us is how can we just stay in stock all of the time and not miss any sales.
And you go, I think you mentioned earlier about kind of controlling the sell-through. It's quite interesting when you talk about a £12 price point. I bet it's actually more beneficial to throttle the sales sometimes if you can't fulfil those backup orders.
We, because the business is so big, we generally don't struggle on like having too much stock because someone in the business will sell it. So it's, we would massively overstock rather than understock is what our preference would be.
Definitely. It's a really common strategy that we see in FBM backup strategy, and that's where hybrid and seller comes in a lot more. A lot of brands and people will talk about hybrid strategies as one product on vendor, one product on seller. What they don't see is kind of the complementary benefits of it. That's where they can work really, really well in conjunction. And it seems to be becoming more and more frequent, I'd say, from what I'm seeing.
From a seller perspective, toggling between FBA and FBM is a strategy that everybody should be utilizing because sometimes you cannot plan for a stock out to happen. But if you've got that FBM listing sat in the background, you're not going to have a full stock out. You're still going to be able to get that product sent to your customers. The only thing with seller is if you are looking at SFP, you have to be 100% sure that you can really do that and do it well. Because the amount of clients or businesses that attempt SFP don't hit all the percentages that Amazon want and then lose that as a channel is rife. So you just have to be able to operationally fully manage SFP if you are looking into that. But I am a toggling FBA and FBM advocate.
SFP seems to be a bit of a golden star almost. Like, I seem to speak to a lot of brands about everybody wants to do it, but then when you get into the caveats and the nuances that sit around it, there seems to be so many KPIs you have to hit.
Our
warehouse is exceptional and they wouldn't be able to hit it. And it's like it's next day pretty much the whole time, but they still wouldn't be able to hit the all of the KPIs for it.
Because most of the time it's not even your warehouse. I mean, your warehouse can pick, pack, get ready, prep it, but if you're logistical delivery partner has a 3 p.m. cutoff. Sorry, you've missed the boat there. And it's not anything of you, but Amazon doesn't see it like that. They see it as it's an entirety. So if you don't have a good fulfillment sort of partner, essentially, that can pick up your products any time of day and make sure it gets sent out for next day delivery, you kind of shot in the foot there for saying that you can't control.
Even FBM monitoring is really tight. Those percentages, the amount of times that we log into somebody's dashboard and there's a warning because the percentage is 0.01% higher than it should be. Like anything outside of FBA, Amazon do it on purpose. They make it quite difficult because obviously they want that FBA.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. You know, the algorithm favours it as well.
100%.
I think the big...
What we find as well is sort of a mix between the hybrid model and just the consumer sort of intent is with low ASP products, so de-icer is the prime example for us. If we're out of stock on the vendor side, we can't afford to do the single de-icer because they retail at like £4, £3. We just can't do that on the seller side. But people are lazy, so they would rather pay £12 and get it delivered to the house than go out to the supermarket and spend £3 and get it from there. So it does work. Casing, putting cases on there, it really does work.
Mm-hmm. I am that person.
Yeah, I was about to say, I am people.
The people is me.
It's a convenience factor, though. It is.
Yeah. So, you pay £10 more not to have to leave your house.
Yeah. And that'd cost you about 30p in petrol or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Or even me, where my local Sainsbury's is like a 2-minute walk. But I, no, not for me to go there.
I think the big takeaway from that, from kind of what I'm hearing, is have some kind of backup option. Whether that's another fulfillment option, another fulfillment partner, or even throttling sales if you physically can't fulfill them to maintain your velocity. I guess the last point on this topic then is, how do you plan for cut-off dates and how do you manage that kind of last-minute approach? Because we all know what Amazon are like. They will pile POs in. Bulk buys are quite a common thing that we see around this as well. What's your top tips to manage it?
I'd say preempt it. Definitely preempt it. If you've got a good relationship with your VM and your AVS, just have an open and frank conversation and be like, look, when do you think is going to be the last date but you guys will be sending the biggest POs? Obviously, they don't always know because Amazon's quite siloed, so they'll have to speak to an in-stock manager and all those good things. But preempt it. Have it pick-packed ready in your warehouse, palletized, shrink-wrapped, whatever you want to have it do. So as soon as that comes through, within the hour, you can have it sent off, because also, it's not just your side of things. Any extra delays that are at the warehouse or capacity constraints, you're going to get turned away. Yeah. So that's adding an extra day onto your delivery. It might be a little bit of a later delivery or capacity constraint again. Go to another warehouse that might be halfway across the country. So I'd say golden tip is preempted. Have everything pre-packed, ready to go, even if it's like at a big oven. Bigger amount, you can always take less off, but you can't add more on once you've sent it off, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%.
I think monitor the POs. So I'm sure everybody sees this, but we always see that if we reject, I don't know, 20,000 units or something, the next week they'll order 30,000 or 35,000. Yeah. Monitor that, put it into your forecast as quickly as you can. Maybe you can't get it for the next PO day, but maybe you can get it for two or three down the line. But they generally hold for us, for our sort of products, between 8 and 10 weeks cover.
Yeah.
So they're not going to go out of stock unless you really don't accept anything. So they will continue to order it so they can maintain that level.
Yeah. So perspective, anything different?
It's very, very different for FBA because we're not working with POs. It's more how you can logistically send the stock in yourself. Yeah. But again, with FBA warehouses, you have to do it sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
The cutoff dates aren't always that clear. It can be a case of, we're just not accepting any more shipments at the moment. And that's it, like, you're stuck. So to ensure that you are fully, fully prepared, you just have to send them as early as possible.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with the seller side of things, they're not clear.
Yeah.
It's, you start the shipment plan and then it's a computer says no situation. So
I think with that as well, go big on seller, but also make sure you check your removal order settings, because if you go too early or too big too early, then it could be a mess for you.
Yeah.
Extend those settings.
Of course, if you are watching this live, please get your questions down into the questions box for us, and our team will pick those up and answer them for you. Moving down onto planning now. So we've kind of started to talk about planning from a stock fulfillment promotional activity perspective. When does all this start? I'll come to you, Tom, because I know we were laughing about this the other day.
We'll be planning for winter during the summer months, and then we'll be planning for summer during the winter. Yeah. So we do it the complete opposite. We generally do that as a business because all the retailers want you to plan. Like, literally now people are sourcing for de-icer for Christmas time. So it's we literally are just starting to do it now.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me, especially when you're talking about vendor, because you were saying you're starting to see a significant uplift in POs already, haven't you?
Yeah, so we're seeing, like probably 300% up on what a normal month would be for us. So they're starting to stock up very heavily. We did make this a massive point last year because we just couldn't get any stock in.
Yeah.
And so we've sort of, in our... it's the vendor growth plan, I think it's called now. We just can't have the same again. So we've gone down the direct fulfillment route as well. So we've just set up the direct fulfillment side of the warehouse. So we're putting things in place to actually be able to fulfill the orders this year.
That's good.
We just had it 2 or 3 years in a row. And in sales meetings, we always go into our owner saying, look, they just won't buy anything. There's no room. So this year it was like, well, we can't have that as an excuse anymore, basically. So how can we do it? And that's what we're looking at doing.
Yeah. Do you use many of the Amazon fulfillment programs then? Because obviously there's so many picks, VendorFlex, SuperPix.
We tried to do SuperPix in the EU, but it was extortionate.
Yeah.
Or they said we couldn't do it, basically. So there was no flex on it. I think we got quoted 8% for Pix in the UK this year. But our distribution cost is like 3% or something. So it just makes absolutely no sense for us to do it. We actually don't. The only one we're looking at is direct fulfillment, but it's set up as a complete new vendor code. And the costs are exactly the same as what they would be on a normal vendor code.
Yeah. So we'll just spend a second on that AVA conversation and Pix. It was a massive ask this year, wasn't it? Pix and SuperPix more than anything.
So many, but I mean, 8%, I think your vendor manager has been very ambitious. They were like really money hungry. He wanted to go to his senior category leads and be like, mate, unbulk them, let's go.
What's interesting on that is they accidentally sent an email to us, which had all of our competitor like names on it. They didn't send any data, but it had the competitor name on it. So we think he just sent a flat file out to all of his customers and just said, look, this is what we were asking for this year. So
shame we didn't have net PPM tags.
but back to your question, Pix has been mental. And I mean, it does make sense for some brands. I mean, we've got one or two customers where their Pix warehouse is basically in the business park right next to where they fulfill. I mean, if you really wanted to, you could drive a forklift across the road and drop it off. Then it makes sense. It's excellent. It's cool. But if you've already got long established logistical routes and you've got really good logistical partners with great freight rates, I mean, do you really want to sever those relationships off for short-term gain? Who knows, maybe next year Pix doesn't work for you anymore and then you need to go groveling back to your old partners and you're not going to get the same historical rates that you will. So respect the relationships you have unless it makes absolute sense to move into Pix or SuperPix, direct fulfillment, vendor flex, whatever sort of program you want to put a name on it.
Yeah. I mean, you could. What we did was we used to have 3PO days in the EU. We changed it to one and then set relatively high MOVs. And it's not quite Pix, but it's nearly as good as Pix because they can't order. They have to hit the limit for it to work for us. So.
That's a really clever way of doing it because otherwise Amazon sends a PO for like 3 units of saying, you know, like, it's going to cost me more to pick this product than it is to actually even ship the product. That makes zero sense.
PO acceptance rate tanks as well because you can't do it.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a knock on effect, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, perfect. And then going back to kind of the seller vendor conversation, because I think this is where we'll see a massive shift in how you can manage those platforms differently and the benefit of kind of that hybrid approach. Obviously, we tend to see POs coming through sort of June, July, maybe slightly earlier for that Christmas peak, especially in those busier categories, as you rightly said. Seller's going to be a little bit more advantageous potentially in this instance of how you can manage that stock.
Yeah, Prime Day's really scuppered a lot of people's plans for Q4 because of the 4-day event that apparently we're planning for. The stock management has already become an issue because everyone is panic sending product into the fulfillment centers. So it's a case of us understanding how this July Prime Day works and how we operate that for August, September, October. But ideally, we would be starting to input the stock now.
Yeah.
I think clients are having to take more of a cost effective strategy in place now because they are going to be paying for storage fees.
Yeah.
It is going to be more costly to plan ahead of the Q4 period. But this July 4-day Prime Day has really set people back a bit in their planning and how we operate.
Definitely. It's a bit of an unknown, the 4 days as well, isn't it?
From an ads perspective, from all aspects of Prime Day, it's all new.
Yeah. How, this is a really good point on the ads, but how do you budget ads around these kind of peak periods?
I think first and foremost, obviously look at like historical data.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you do previously? What worked well? What didn't go well? What was your cost per click? And then obviously probably put on a 30 to 50% markup on it because your competitors are going to be going aggressive bidding on placements. You want to win those placements. So your cost per click is going to go up massively. So make sure you put in extra budget. Also, if you are running deals, don't drive traffic to ASINs where there's no deals unless they are hero products and they sell themselves. Yeah. Obviously do that. But if you are running deals, run traffic to those deals, highlight the deals, shout about it, let people know. So the advertising side of things is It's going to be an interesting one over 4 days. I think it's going to be a bit of a bloodbath at times. So all I know is I'm glad I'm not doing that.
It's line by line strategy again, because it is going to be so costly to run across the 4 days. You're looking at double what you were already planning for. So, and then you're adding the 30-40% increase in ads budget.
Just going back to that, expecting to kind of double or triple that budget, do you think the same consistency will maintain across the 4 days, or do you think it'll be a peak for the typical 2 days and then sort of slow off?
I think it'll be a peak. Although, as you said, Emma, people do look after the deal events now as well. So whether it's part of that, I mean, in terms of advertising, we do have an increased budget for it, but there are lines where it just won't work for us. We have a really low ASP, so I think our ASP is about £7.50, which on vendor is pretty low. So some of them just don't work for us, but we have an amazing advertising team internally, so they'll just be looking at everything, and we use different software and things to help us do that.
I think it also depends on what type of deal you're running. So if you're running a best deal, you can run it for a longer period, obviously, but if you're running like a lightning deal, that's like boom, really short, really sharp, hammer in as much advertising as you can and really drive the sort of visibility on it, get the sellout, and then the deal's done. But if you're running multi-day deals, you need to continually probe and make sure that your bids are accurate, you're top of search, you've got the visibility there, you're not running out of stock, back to stock topic, but there's a lot of moving parts that you need to be conscious of and continually checking sort of on an hour-by-hour basis, not just a fire and forget and let's hope for the best. It's needs to be done properly.
It's a very hands-on approach as well, isn't it? I guess specifically with advertising, because that's the one thing you can impact very, very quickly as well. And I guess that's probably the difference, I guess, in vendor and seller massively there. And you were kind of talking about contributions, discounts, ads. I probably guess that's why it's probably quite important to have a good VIP or JBP with Amazon, because if they're asking for contributions to discounts and you've got to increase your ad spend.
It's a
double-edged sword. Yeah.
I mean, we just don't get that much collaboration from Amazon, to be honest, around deal events. It's just the bottom line of it, really. we generally, well, we give them what we can fund. A lot of the time they say no, and we would just say, all right, fine, we just won't, they will not go on promotion then. That's about it, really. They do match some of the funding on some lines, but in the US they just won't do that. In the US, we see it completely different. At deal events, if your ASP is too low, they won't let you advertise because they don't want to sell things that they won't be making money on. Whereas in the UK, we don't really see that. We saw Amazon, that they wouldn't really care. You're spending money with them, it doesn't really matter to them.
So
we do see it very different in the US to the UK. There's a little bit more support here, but in the US it's just not that
support. It's a whole different ball game in the US.
and back in the day, you used to get really nice support from Amazon. You could say, hey, I'm going to give you X amount of SOA, but then I want my hero product to be guaranteed in the deal tile, for example, which is, I mean, it's not like an explicit sort of value, but I mean, if it's the first product the customer sees, it's more than like the first one they're going to click on. So you could get sort of little niche advantages of, hey, I want to be included in the deal tile. I want free billboard placements and free banner placements, those types of things. Whereas now Amazon just says, nope, have a nice day. Give us 30% SOA and that's it. So I think the extra benefits that you get from giving the funding are just sort of getting less and less and less. And it's pure just pay to play, essentially, more than anything now.
100%.
We're seeing more and more where they just take the funding and put it on the deal like that. I mean, they've always done that, but they're doing it more and more now is what we're seeing.
And again, this comes back to and again, I know you talk about this a lot, Trav, but obviously those terms enforcements of those co-op accruals, or however it's worded within your terms, to make sure you're getting the most of it. And we've seen a lot of cases where we've just asked the VM or AVS or whoever it is, what are they actually doing with that accrual? And it very quickly starts to materialize into something.
Definitely ask. I mean, if you're getting like marketing and development funds and your AVS or your VM isn't letting you know your marketing balance, that should be an alarm bell going off right there. Be like, hey, what's my marketing balance? I'd like to spend it on banners and billboards. I mean, you're not going to get any data out of it because Amazon says, oh, sorry, we don't have data on that. Which, don't know if I believe that or not, but at least you're spending it on saying that you're getting value out of it. It's like, it's a give and a get sort of framework, which I always say to our clients, like, develop a give and a get. What do you give and what do you get out of it? So if you don't have a high returns rate, for example, why are you asking for 3 or 4% on returns? I'd rather put 2% into a promo pot that I can use to fund SOAs, or a margin pot where I can fund MCP funding for margin matching. Make it work for you where at least you can get an outcome out of it. You're not just giving money to Amazon and essentially getting nothing out of it type thing. So make your terms work for you. Mm-hmm. Easier said than done, because some VMs are great, some VMs aren't, some AVS are, some AVS aren't. It really just depends on that relationship. But to your best of ability, make your terms work for you, and it does pay dividends down the line.
So yeah, flipping that into a seller world, obviously you do have so much more control. One, the data, as you said there, Trav, but also the price point thing.
Yeah, there's a lot less stress when it comes to price points. The only issue is the buy box. We just need to ensure that you are properly competing. If you are struggling with the buy box problem, there has to be a strategy in place where you are ensuring that you're going to win that. We're seeing that now. It's becoming more and more difficult to maintain the buy box. So we just need to take that into consideration. Whenever you're getting to those peak seasons, people have got automatic pricing tool set.
Yeah.
So if you've got a really strong competitor, they will constantly be fighting for you and for that space. So you need to set that up as well. You have to be ready for that fight, really. Yeah.
And do you know what? It comes back to that always on strategy, which somebody kind of mentioned earlier, of managing the wider retail distribution models that you have as well. Because obviously it's very easy to get into bed with Amazon, but if you don't manage that channel, it very, very quickly gets out of control.
Yeah, you can't just sit and leave it. You are in it all day, every day. Yeah. And that's why we're in the position that we're in.
Yeah.
Because sometimes clients just cannot spend the time that they need to fully maintain.
And I feel like I'll just take this off now.
let's
get in the game. Now we're talking. I think Amazon will just sell you a dream, in all honesty. Yeah. And they always do. We see it time and time again. Yeah, invest in this. Like, you'll see great returns. Yeah, we can't tell you what returns, but you see great returns. And they never do. It's just, it's an accretive margin thing for Amazon. So like you mentioned, customers get sold a dream and then they come backtrack to us and say, hey, look, my terms are too high. How can I backtrack from this? How can I make them work better? So I think from the beginning stage, don't be afraid to say no. Don't be afraid to do what's best for your business. Ultimately, end of the day, let's be honest, Amazon likes you as a customer, but they don't care, they don't need your business type thing. They've got competition, so do what's best for your business, margin, your sort of clients.
100%. And we always talk about it as a traditional buyer-seller relationship. That's what it should be. Obviously, sometimes it's not viewed as that because Amazon is not a person. It's a computer in a lot of cases. But I think that is what's missed by brands and retailers and sellers, etc., that it is still a buyer-seller relationship and it should still be treated that way and managed that way. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to exactly what you were saying there, Trevor. Don't be afraid to say no. As you rightly said, you can't discount everything or advertise everything.
Nope.
It doesn't work for you. You have to make those decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're quite an old school business, like a traditional type business, so that sort of, that's embedded into you as Tetris. Yeah. You need that sort of traditional relationship with the buyer, so we try and do that, but you're right, it's very difficult. You can't do a deal on buy a truckload of this and we'll give you x amount off, because they'll put it in the system and it'll say we can't buy that quantity.
The computer says you can't buy that quantity,
so we can't do it. So it's a little bit different.
So we've obviously spoken about how competitive deal events are, and you have to be competing in or participating in some way, shape or form. That doesn't always mean you have to discount, though. You can absolutely talk about your ad strategy. You can talk about retail price point. You can talk about bundling, all that kind of thing. What's the one key takeaway you'd all give about how do you compete in such a crowded market when it comes to those deal events?
One thing from my side that I think is really good is Amazon exclusives. In all honesty, something where you give Amazon that value, you make them feel nurtured and cared for. Oh, cute Amazon. But also customers, it's the only place where you can get it, essentially. Yeah. So Amazon exclusives work exceptionally well. It protects your margin. You know you're not price matching. You've already factored in your margin and what level you can discount to. And essentially, yeah, if you can give Amazon something like that and you're not competing on price points, you know it's the only one in the market and you're only competing with a few other external competitors, I'd say that's a pretty good way of moving into things. So Amazon exclusives from my side is build an exclusive, whether it's an exclusive bundle, exclusive color, exclusive size of a product, exclusive formulation or flavor, whatever it is, just make it so it's available on Amazon and customers have to go to Amazon to buy it and they can't get anywhere else. So I think exclusives from my side is a really cool one.
Do you know what? I really like that one, actually. And going back to the retailer discount promo events that they're going into, if you have Tesco Boots going into discount, you don't have to compete because you're not going to lose the buy box.
The bundles are
something
like you can get a lower margin product attached to a higher margin product and really toggle that profitability. You're creating something that's exclusive for Amazon. There are so many different ways of bundling from a seller perspective now, where you don't even have to create the bundle yourself, ship it to an FBA fulfillment center and they do it for you. There's so many different ways of toggling that. But from a seller perspective, I think we touched on it before, it's the design.
Yeah.
It's the brand presence. It's the getting across who you are as a brand. That can make such a difference in a purchase, especially for considered purchases. People are piling their Amazon baskets full of stuff ahead of Prime Day. And it inevitably, it's price or whether they trust that brand. If you are perfectly retail ready, your designs are out there and you're really bringing across that brand presence, the conversion piece is there and you are likely to win against your competitors.
I feel like you could talk about content for a while.
Content is mine.
I think that's what I was just going to say as well, is the content for us is the one way. It's the cheapest way of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have the exact same screen wash in the summer and the winter. And in the winter, we'll literally change the label on the image to show some snowflakes in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And in the summer, we'll change it so that it's like a sun or it's like rays that are coming down.
Yeah.
So it's literally the exact same product. We'll change the titles. In the winter, it's minus 15.
Yeah.
In the summer, it's a summer screen wash. it's the little tweaks, I think, make a massive difference.
Yeah. I used to do a lot of work on CRO and how people purchase and what they see first, and it's changing wording like basket to bag, or there's so many little things that you can do in content that you said, it's free. If you've got someone in house or if your agency is already doing your design work, it's a quick change and that instantly changes in how the customer's purchasing.
Yeah.
So like you said, changing the color of something from a summer color to a winter color, it changes conversion rates and it helps boost that performance. So
yeah,
content for me is key.
So I think three quite clear takeaways then there. So mm-hmm. Amazon exclusives, no competition from wider retail.
Mm-hmm.
Bundling,
mm-hmm.
really, really good option, good way to maximize margin. And then the content side of it as well.
Yeah.
Big one. Yeah. Cool. Keep those questions coming. Our team will be picking those up in the answer box below. Let's dive into content then. I can see Emma's sat on the edge of her seat ready to go.
She's been waiting for this. Let's go.
I do completely agree with you. I think it's a massively overlooked thing. And when we talk about content and updates, people do think exactly what you just said. A bit of Christmas tinsel on a banner. That's what people see as updates. But actually, it's so much more. I remember you were teaching me about the difference in how male consumers shop versus female consumers. Yeah. I think there's so much opportunity.
There really is. Like, not to be horrible towards men, but you do see that the purchasing behavior for men completely changes. Yeah. I used to work in fashion retail, and the amount of men that would rock up on Christmas Eve and say, I need to buy something for my wife. And they would panic buy. Mm-hmm. And it's the same online. It's panic buy. How quickly can I get that product? I haven't thought about it until the 22nd of December. Now I need that.
Yeah.
And there is more of a planning sort of purchasing behavior when it comes to especially parents who are looking for those deals for their kids for toys. I think Christmas wish lists from kids are way beyond the Argos catalog and a pen now. It's a spreadsheet and it's the money that kids are expecting.
Hundreds and hundreds of pounds.
Hundreds and hundreds of pounds. So the price competitiveness, how you are changing that content. I always treat, or I like to treat, Amazon as you would any other e-commerce website or high street store. You change your visuals according to the season. So Father's Day coming up, you change the visuals to be more masculine, more towards Father's Day. And the same goes for Q4. You have to make it visually impactful.
Yeah.
And I think tone of voice also comes into play quite a little bit. Softer, more messaging for more feminine products, and maybe more cutesy messaging for like kid style products, and a little bit more like, I don't want to say aggressive because that's not the right word, but for more masculine style products, it really comes into play. But also just changing words, like you mentioned earlier, gifts for mum, gifts for dad, small little bits and pieces I get to also feed the algorithm. That's the SEO side of things. But obviously, once you start looking at the images, most shoppers, I mean, when last did anyone actually buy something off Amazon on their computer? I cannot remember the time I do it. It's me doom scrolling at night.
Yeah. Or, I'm like, or B2B. Don't forget the B2B side of it.
Yeah, fair enough. But I mean, it's still such a small proportion of it overall. Most customers, I think 80% in the UK shop on mobile. Yeah. And the first thing you're greeted by is the images. So images need to have good infographics. They need to have the USPs in all the products at a glance. What's its use case? What's the benefits of using it? What's the size? What's the flavor? What's the concentration? You don't have to go and look for your answers. You just want to have your answers given to you. Mm-hmm. I'll self-admit, I'm a lazy Amazon shopper. I just want to search, click buy, three clicks on my way home, done, easy. Yeah. So yeah, I think messaging comes into it, infographics comes into it, and just ease of shoppability.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think even things like review harvesting, which I remember we spoke about some time ago, didn't we? Looking at what your competitors are missing out on or doing wrong, because they're the points that the consumers are actually looking for. That's such a powerful
really
data point.
One.
Look into your reviews, pick out the positive things and create USPs within your graphics on what people are positively reviewing.
Yeah.
Then you're ahead of the game really with 100%.
Competitors. Yeah. Obviously, you spoke on seasonality, and that's obviously summer, winter, quite a definitive cutoff. Sorry. Would you change it for each peak event? So that prime cyber Q4 peak?
In terms of the content?
Yeah.
We wouldn't necessarily do that. First of all, I don't think we struggle to get images live a lot of the time.
Yeah.
It can take up to a month. Generally, it's a couple of days, but we just... it's not reactive enough for us, so we don't have the ability to do that. Not sure whether we necessarily would because of the type of products we have.
Yeah.
We generally push different brands. We have 34 brands and they're covering
a lot of variety.
Yeah. So we have 8 car care brands, so each one sits at a different price point, a different quality. So we push different products during different events rather than necessarily the content. We generally try and change the content for our best sellers.
Yeah.
But we have 70,000 ASINs. So there's no way we can change 70,000 ASINs.
Why not?
Somewhere in winter. I mean, we're trying to get like more into AI, but even that, I don't think we'd be able to get 70,000 ASINs.
Your computer's going to be smoking and fizzling and like flaming. You're going to have to use those fire extinguishers you guys sell.
Not left to sell them all.
There you go.
So, I mean, we wouldn't change it between events, but we generally do for the season. But I mean, it depends on the product, I suppose. Yeah. For us, it doesn't work because it's a seasonal product.
Yeah. Would you guys see that across any clients, that there would be that speed of change? Or would you just keep some kind of consistency?
I think the underlying message is definitely the same. I mean, the product's the product regardless of seasonality, but you still need to just convey the actual messaging. So, for example, let's say you're a skincare brand that sells sun cream. Yes, sun cream will be used in summer. That's like the whole beachy idea, go to the beach, wear sunscreen. But also remember, wintertime, people use it for skiing. So same product, just slightly different messaging. But to your point on the images, we see that across the board, and it's super annoying, especially when you have same ASIN within multiple EU regions. Next day, you've got Italian listings with German writing on. You're like, okay, well, this is definitely not going to work type thing. And it's raising the tickets. Or if you have a great AVS, they can action it really quickly. But if you don't, sometimes you're just sitting there doing more firefighting than actual value adding, if that makes sense.
The only one that I would see would be storefronts. So storefronts, there's a lot less hassle changing a top banner.
Yeah.
As you would with any normal e-commerce website, you would change that banner. So... for me, from a seller perspective, it's storefronts are the quick and easy change.
Yeah.
And if people are in that purchasing, like proper purchasing, they are more likely to hit your storefront and shop around.
And product placement, I guess, is key as well, isn't it? What products are people looking to buy? I mean, you see in a traditional retail world that the eye level is buy level. It's the big TVs on payday, the lower price point items you go for the month. It's very similar to
a simple digital world. On your top banner, on your storefront. Adding gifting, something as simple as that.
Yeah, I like the storefront option. No, that's really good because that's your opportunity to basically make it your own, essentially. That's what the feel should be of your own D2C website, if you have one, for example.
Yeah.
Obviously, besides the option that competitors can't advertise and steal that real estate, you can really make it your own feel and give customer the sort of sense of who you are as a brand, what your sort of brand ethos is, what your style is. And you can really cater it to the needs of the customer. But the specific drop downs that you mentioned is a big one. Yeah. Best sellers, new releases, those types of things. It just makes the customer journey easier, essentially.
Yeah.
and you can prep it beforehand, which makes a massive difference. Yeah.
And I did see some data a few days back that said that 30% more customers are likely to look through A+ and storefront during Q4 and the golden quarter. So
that's interesting.
There are more eyes on your design work. So change it, update it, ensure that what they're seeing is relevant for that season.
Yeah, I think it goes into the point where it's also, if your brand still looks terrible, your A+ looks terrible, customers are not going to buy your product because they're like, if they can't put an effort into their listings, then what sort of performance I'm going to get out of this product? Is it going to be like fit for purpose? Is it going to be high quality, or is it going to break the next day type thing? So giving customers that really explicit, like, wow, they've put in a lot of effort into this. They put a lot of love into this. It's a brand that cares about the how they're perceived essentially by the customer. I think that could make or break sales quite a bit.
Data is quite key to this. I mean, you kind of started to talk about a couple of data points there. Power of like AMC as well can be massive in this. And again, some of the demographic data you can get within the ads console can give some significant value.
We've been deep diving a lot more into the demographic, especially within like the jewellery. It's really interesting to see the age demographic of people purchasing jewellery on Amazon and what we're actually targeting, or what our design work is targeting. There's so many changes that you can make just by looking at that simple number.
You lose that finger in the air approach, don't you? You can actually use the data to talk a little bit more.
You could be targeting, like your design work could be targeting a much younger audience, but really you're looking at between like 45 and 50 year olds are purchasing more jewellery on Amazon. So you need to be really proactive with that.
No, I agreed. I think it's a really good point. And I think you can really hone in on who your exact customer is. I mean, you've got the perfect example. I mean, if you guys are in the States, I mean, some states love driving. So you go to Texas, everyone's got a big truck. And like, yeah, we're missioning around. Whereas New York, the only people with cars are probably cab drivers. Everyone else is taking the tube or the metro, as they call it, whatever, or they're taking a bus or they're walking. So you can really fine tune your advertising placements, DSP, AMC, based on the geographical location. So why would you want to send CarGuard stuff to New York drivers where no one's buying it? Rather go to Texas and California where people actually want to buy those products. And yeah, that's the sort of value of the data.
Exactly. I mean, we actually had some really interesting information on that recently, where a mad stat was that in Montana, people have 1.8 cars each.
It's a two-seater and a four-seater.
So you're right, there's a lot more looking at that on at the States. Is we could spend our entire budget in one state easily, whereas we couldn't do that in the UK in a month or anything, where we could just spend there.
We've spoken a lot about static content then. What about video content?
I think it needs to be short, sharp and punchy. Obviously Amazon has its regulations and how long it should be, but I mean, if you think about it, if you go on Instagram, Facebook Shorts, well, whatever it is nowadays, everything is short form media. People don't have attention spans anymore, sadly. So if you're not getting the messaging across within the first, arguably 3 to 5 seconds, where it's short, sharp, punchy and fit for purpose, people are just going to scroll by. So have longer form videos, maybe within your actual product listings. But once you get into the advertising side of things, you want short, sharp, punchy videos just to gain the interest. Get them onto the display page or your product detail page rather, and then you sort of educate them on the actual product. So
especially for those two main categories, so beauty and kids toys, beauty videos, everyone's addicted to watching those on TikTok at the moment. So if you can get that in front of your audience with an Amazon, really short form, catchy beauty videos, you're going to fly with that. And with toys, parents like to see what that physically looks like, because I'm a parent that will not step foot in a toy shop because it's stressful. I'd rather buy it online. So if I can see how big that toy is, how much space it's going to take in my home, you need that short, you need that really quick, captivating video content.
I mean, we do exactly what you've just said, really. I mean, we have the longer form videos on the listing, so we have a lot of how-to videos. We have an oil range where we'll have a how to do an oil change, but on the actual advertising, it's just short, snappy, sort of in your face if you like, but just really makes the impact. It's one thing we're actually targeting a little bit more this year, because our video content internally, we're a traditional business, and I know there's loads. I speak to so many people where they say the business is still just bricks and mortar and it's just getting into Amazon. So nobody has video content unless you're an e-com site originally. So we're just getting into more videos now.
Kind of like that though, because then you're also just buying into the brand. It's not just a video on the product. It's like how to learn an extra skill. I mean, how to change oil, how to deglaze. How to deglaze your windscreen, for example, not just how to use the product. You're actually educating the customer on a life lesson, but also slotting in your products into that as well, which I think customers do appreciate at the end of the day. Like, it's like, I've learned something, but I've also learned the benefits of using the product and how that sort of relates to the overall process. The
customer journey again.
Again, I was going to say, kind of last point for me, I'm conscious we're kind of wrapping up, but again, the ads formats that will unlock for you.
Mm-hmm.
You can do so much more with DSP, top of funnel, product placements. It gives you so much more availability, especially when you're trying to build brands like you guys are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. Well, look, thank you very much for joining us today, guys. And thank you very much for everyone that's been listening in. If you've got any questions or queries off the back of this or any topics we've not covered or any questions or anything that, you know, we haven't managed to cover, please feel free to drop them over to us and we can introduce you directly to the relevant person who can answer that question for you. But other than that, thank you very much for your time today and thank you very
Merry Christmas.
Goodbye, everybody.